The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We have the Book Nook coming up for you this morning. A. Scott Berg returns to the program. The last time he was here, he had written a biography of President Woodrow Wilson, who on April 2nd, 1917, gave a speech before a joint session of Congress and announced that he thought it was time to declare war on Germany. World War I was underway. The United States joined in on April 6th of 1917. We'll be talking to Scott Berg about World War I and America, told by the Americans who lived it. He was the editor, right after the news. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today A. Scott Berg. Hello, Scott.
It's nice to be talking to you again, Vic.
Scott, I was so delighted when I received this new book from the Library of America. You were the editor for it. It's called World War I and America, Told by the Americans Who Lived It. And we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of the entry of the United States in World War I. And what a timely book. How did you get involved with this project?
Well, I think it is an extremely timely book. You know, I spent about 13 years writing my biography of Woodrow Wilson. And during that time, I kept wishing there were a book just like this, which is one that told a brisk narrative of the war through, you know, a real Whitman sampler. In this case, we have about 85 different writers, or in some case, people who weren't professional writers, who happened to be there and kept diaries and journals, or we have war correspondents and so forth. So through their works, we can narrate the life of the war as it was being lived. And as soon as my book was finished, or a few years after that, the Library of America, which specializes in, you know, individual volumes on authors, periodically does a special volume on an event or a subject, such as baseball or whatever. And it occurred to them that we were coming up to the 100th anniversary of America's entry into the war, and they asked if I'd be interested in compiling this book. So basically, I worked from initially tens of thousands and then down to about 1,200 pieces, and then with a panel of historians and wonderful people at the Library of America, we winnowed it down to about 130 selections, which we've put into this volume.
And it is an incredible variety of material. We get all kinds of different viewpoints, and we follow the chronology of the war. So we have viewpoints of people before the United States entered the war, through the period when we did enter, and then even a little bit afterwards. Tell us how you decided to do the structure on this.
Well, it struck me that this really was a three-act play, that the war lasted from 1914 to 1918, but we were not in the war until 100 years ago, until 1917. So there was that first act of the America having one of its great debates. You know, we had a great debate when forging this country about what a constitution should be and what this country should be. We had a great debate preceding the Civil War, whether we have slavery or not, and whether we were in fact two countries. And then we had the next great debate, as to what is the identity, what is the nature, what is the character of the United States. And it was Woodrow Wilson, the president, one of the most eloquent presidents we've ever had, and certainly the most educated president we ever had, who helped the country wrestle with this fact. What is our identity? What is our role in the world now that we have become extremely successful and powerful? And so that's basically the first act, is this progression of leading an isolationist country, which we were, with a small army the size of that of Portugal's, into this great universal conflagration. The second act is the actual war itself, when we are actually in it. And how do you mobilize this nation that didn't have an armed force? And how do you muster 2 or 3 million men to go overseas, not just crossing a river, but crossing an ocean to fight this war? And why were we fighting it? And what was the actual day-to-day battle like? And then there is part three, which is in some ways the most important part of the war, because Woodrow Wilson really believed the reason we should get involved in it was so that we could help write the peace. And Wilson had a whole new concept of what the new world order should be. And that was based really largely around a concept he had called the League of Nations. And Woodrow Wilson believed that there should be, almost like King Arthur's, there should be a round table at which all countries could gather before they went to war to discuss a possible settlement. And so Act Three of this really becomes Woodrow Wilson's drive to get us involved in a League of Nations, to accept the treaty he brought back from Paris. And in our not joining it, in essence, well, either way, however it was going to go, the 20th century was being forged at this point. And I say, and this is a bold statement, but every big theme in this country today, whether it's domestic policy, the economy, certainly our foreign policy, the role of African Americans, the role of women, the role of the United States dealing with Soviet Russia, all these things, every single one of these themes goes directly back to these three acts of this World War I drama. So that's how the book got put together.
Hey, Scott Burke joins us. He's the editor of World War I and America, Told by the Americans Who Lived It. The last time we had you on the program was for your biography of Woodrow Wilson, who was elected president in 1912. A Democrat, the first Democrat elected in some time, and he won because the vote was split. The second place finisher was a guy named Teddy Roosevelt, who ran as an independent, as a Bull Moose Party candidate, and he cost the Republican candidate the election, in my viewpoint. And then after Wilson was elected and the war started a couple years later, Teddy was one of the most vitriolic critics of Wilson, and you have some of his stuff in the book, and Teddy just was relentless, wasn't he?
Relentless, never let up, so wanted to be president of the United States, and he was a real saber rattler, and he very much wanted to get us into the war. And this goes to this debate I was talking about, and I would say there were two leading spokesmen at this moment. Initially, it was Teddy Roosevelt, who desperately wanted us in the war, and Woodrow Wilson kept saying, no, we must remain neutral, and not only impartial in our actions, said Woodrow Wilson, but even in our thoughts. And every time Wilson gave a speech like this about how we had to stay out of the war, TR would then give another speech, you know, saying how we had to get into it. Gradually, over 1914, 15, with the sinking of the Lusitania, into 1916, where the Germans are still, they're torpedoing neutral ships, American lives are being lost, the German government is ignoring all of Wilson's pleas, really to change their modus operandi, and finally it became inevitable that we had to get in this war. And in 1916, Wilson did campaign on the slogan, he kept us out of war. But shortly after his inauguration in March, Wilson realized it was all but inevitable that we had to get in. There was the discovery of something called the Zimmerman telegram, in which it was revealed in an encrypted telegram that Germany was plotting with Mexico to get them in on their side, and there was a promise that they would get some of their territory back, parts of the American Southwest. And at this point, Wilson realized it was simply a thing we had to do. And on April 2nd, 1917, President Wilson assembled a joint session of Congress. And at that Congress, he gave a speech, which I think is the most important foreign policy in American history. And embedded in that speech is a single sentence: the world must be made safe for democracy. A lot of people didn't even know what he meant. To this day, some people disagree vehemently with it. Whether you agree with it, whether you like it or not, that single sentence has been the bedrock of all American foreign policy. And when people talk about, are we the policemen of the world? Has America gone from being peacemakers to peacekeepers? All of that goes back to that Wilsonian doctrine. So, indeed, we live with this war every day.
You're listening to The Book Nook, and the program will continue right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO as we're looking back on World War I. I think it's easy to forget a century later that when all this was going on, you had the saber rattlers who wanted to go to war, the Teddy Roosevelts. You had the isolationists like Wilson who wanted us to stay out of it. And then you had a very powerful anti-war movement, and you have a number of voices of that movement in your book. We also have a number of reporters filing from the field, and I love so many of these. One that really struck me was when the Germans were just going into Belgium, you had Richard Harding Davis filing for the New York Tribune, and he starts off the article by being very impressed by the German army and how many of them there were and how efficient they seemed to be. But by the end of the dispatch, he's very upset because he says it's war on the defenseless and he sees civilians being killed. And we can see a little turn in attitude there.
Exactly right. And, well, you've pointed out five interesting things in what you just said. One of which is there was this fantastic generation of war correspondents covering World War I, and I think the best of them was Richard Harding Davis. And the second big point you just raised is that it was in this coverage of the war, especially Richard Harding Davis's pieces, and especially people who were writing about what had happened to poor Belgium, which got trampled on simply because they happened to be in the way of the German army getting to France. And because of that, and because of these dispatches that were filed daily, weekly, gradually the United States got over this sense of isolationism. And at a certain point, Woodrow Wilson, who had always been, even though he said he had to be neutral, really was pro-British, began leading us into the war by introducing something brand new to American foreign policy, and that was a moral component. And at a certain point, Wilson was arguing that the United States couldn't just sit back any longer and watch as this bully was basically destroying this tiny, defenseless country, Belgium. And it was these dispatches from the front that really helped get us into the war. And I must say, one of the most interesting things for me putting the book together was to discover that Edith Wharton, for example, you know, the brilliant novelist and a society matron, here she was on the front in Belgium and France, actually sending dispatches back home. I had no idea she had done such riveting war reportage. It was really fascinating. And the book is just filled with surprises like that. Wonderful women who were nurses who kept diaries and wrote articles about what was going on over there. And then, of course, the tentpoles of this book become the incredible speeches of Woodrow Wilson, he being so eloquent and he being the last president to have written every one of his own speeches. And you really see the shift in his sentiment and how he is gradually pulling the population of the United States along with him.
Well, they call it the war to end all wars, and in my book, it's the most horrifying war in history. War is always horrifying, but when you read an account like the one from John Reed, the 50-mile grave in Serbia, April 1915, talk about surprises and stunning violence. Unbelievable. My eyes were popping out of my head reading this account.
It really is unbelievable, and you also have to recall, as the book reminds you, this was a new warfare. There were new means and new weapons with which soldiers fought. It was no longer just somebody firing a gun at another person. The poison gases that were used in this war, the bombs, aerial attacks are now being used in war. So there was a dehumanization that was going on. And with that comes, it didn't have a name yet, really, but there really was post-traumatic stress as well. And we've included a few medical records in here, medical reports, filings, that describe what we now call PTSD.
The book is World War I and America, Told by the Americans Who Lived It, published by the Library of America. A. Scott Berg edited the book, and he joins us on the program today. This is just so well done, and so many of these correspondents didn't live to see the end of the war. One of them was a gentleman named Alan Seeger.
Alan Seeger is one of the great stories, and he turns out to have been one of America's great poets, and writes a poem of great foreboding that he possibly would not get back from the war, a man who had a rendezvous with death, and was also parenthetically the nephew of Pete Seeger, who would certainly emerge as a great peace activist a generation later with his folk music. But there are so many people like this. It's a reason also I wanted to throw in a few of the songs of the day so you can see how the sentiments were shifting. It was important to me to throw in Will Rogers and a few of his jokes, because this was really the first time we had stand-up political comedy, which we did. And here was a comedian who used to play in front of Woodrow Wilson and tell jokes about the war and the peace and what was going on in Versailles. It's such a wealth of material. And the beauty of it, for me, I felt like a choral director. You know, I need to bring in a little humor here. I need to bring in some reportage there. And the real ugliness of this war, which raises the question, was this war necessary? Was it a war of choice, or was it a war of necessity? And indeed, at the end of the day, is any war one of choice or necessity?
And down on the ground, as they fought in a stalemate for the first couple of years in their trenches, and it was just horrific. Above them, we had the early aviators, and there was almost something chivalric about them early in the war. You have a wonderful account in here by Herbert Bayard Swope about an early German ace, and how the other pilots from Britain and France, they wanted to be shot down by him. If they had to go, that was the guy they wanted to get him.
You've got it exactly right. This war comes at the end of the old world and the beginning of the new. And in some ways, it was the last of the romantic wars, as it is also the first of the unromantic, ugly wars to be fought. And there was a great sense of chivalry, and before, or at least in the beginning, and certainly in the air, because in the beginning, before America was actually a combatant, there were a lot of people on this side of the ocean who were just so moved by the cause of what was going on there, what Britain and France were fighting for, that a lot of American men and women simply volunteered and went over there. A lot of men went and joined the Foreign Legion. A lot of women went over as nurses. One woman who writes in the book, Mary Borden, built a hospital over there. But indeed, there were a lot of Ivy Leaguers, especially, who went over to fly airplanes. And they joined something called the Lafayette Escadrille. And this, they really were knights of the air. You've hit it exactly. There was a great sense of chivalry, of honor, as to what they were doing. And it points up something really important about this war for the United States, which is that we were never attacked. We went over, as Woodrow Wilson said, to fight for an idea. But what Woodrow Wilson would say is we fought for ideals. Mm. And that was it. We were fighting for these rather almost romantic, idealistic concepts. And so it becomes a very interesting war to read about, because the language that expresses these themes is highly eloquent.
Scott, I think it's also easy to forget 100 years later that as the war was going on and before we entered it, a large percentage of Americans were of German descent, and that there were sympathizers. And one of the most famous ones was a guy who I've always admired, a real curmudgeon named H.L. Mencken, and you've included him. I was happy to see he made the cut.
Well, H.L. Mencken, of course, was one of the great American journalists and writers who ever lived, really was an American voice. And he was a German American, and proudly so. And you rightly point out, we had the largest hyphenated population in this country was the German Americans. And so, Mencken is one of these guys, in some ways, was caught in the bind. And in my introduction, I write that this war is largely about identity. It's what they were fighting for over there, because there were these huge autocracies, these giant empires that were falling. And out of them, little countries would be built. And over in this country, it was an identity crisis as well, as people like Mencken had to declare, really, who they were. Woodrow Wilson kept saying, we have to get rid of our hyphens, so that we're no longer German Americans or Italian Americans, but we're just Americans. And that is a positive thing that can come out of war, that wars really do unite nations. Before the war, we were very much at loggerheads with one another. But once we were in it, we were a united front.
I think one of the most interesting things in here is the one by Floyd Gibbons called Wounded, How It Feels to Be Shot. What a fascinating account.
Well, it was, you used the word eye-popping. That one was an eye-popper for me. because just to read the physical sensations. What wonderful writing, you see. And again, this is, this is what this book, World War I in America, attempts to do, is to give you a whole rainbow of all the things that were written about. How do you approach this problem? On one hand, this war is about philosophy, it's about ideas. On the other hand, it's a very raw physical story. What is it like to get shot? What is it like to be living in a trench for months? What is it like when influenza epidemic descends upon not just trenches or countries, but the entire world? So there's that going on at the same time.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. It's the Book Nook. My guest is A. Scott Berg. He's the editor of World War I in America, Told by the Americans Who Lived It, just published by the Library of America as we approach the 100th anniversary of the United States' entry into World War I. If I had to pick one favorite from the entire book, it would be Hervey Allen from Toward the Flame. This reads like a novel. It was gripping.
Well, it was, and of course you picked what became the centerpiece of the book, and most of the excerpts in the book are really just a few pages. This one runs on for some length, and of course he went on to become a very celebrated novelist. I mean, he was just beautiful writer, a great sense of language, and he does write nonfiction so novelistically. I'm not supposed to have favorites, but yeah, I'm smiling right now.
So we agree?
Yes. Well, okay. Yes, we agree.
Okay, I won't tell anybody.
No. You've definitely hit upon it, though, and I it's almost the turning point of the book in so many ways. I mean, it really is the crux of what this collection is about.
At the end of the book, you've carefully chosen a couple of pieces, and the final one, The Body of an American, is so powerful, unbelievably powerful. I think we forget about this writer, but what a writer.
Well, you know, we weren't quite sure how to bring this whole thing to an end, but the writer we're talking about is John Dos Passos, and this is an excerpt taken from his USA trilogy, which is fiction. The entire book is nonfiction, except at the very end, there is a little coda. And I felt it was important to include this coda because for all the wonderful richness of nonfiction writing during this period, the post-war generation is perhaps the most, well, it's one of two of the great generations in American literature. And I thought we simply can't ignore all the great fiction that came as a result of World War I. You know, as I point out in one of my notes in the book that introduced pieces, you know, Jay Gatsby in The Great Gatsby meets Daisy during World War I. Mm. Ernest Hemingway, of course, you know, writes about war a great deal, but The Sun Also Rises is one of the great post-war novels. Farewell to Arms, you know, his retreat from Caporetto, the whole book takes place during World War I. But, you know, there are pieces in it that are some of the greatest literature ever written, not just about World War I, but any war. And so we felt we had to just give a little taste of some of the fiction. And John Dos Passos, whose fiction walked a very fine line between fiction and nonfiction, because a lot of his work included, again, songs of the day and headlines of the day. And his piece, The Body of an American, that we took from his USA trilogy, really is it's just one of the most moving passages, again, ever written, not just about World War I, but about war altogether. But it really brings the whole collection, I think, to a kind of stunning finale.
My mother's father grew up in a little town in western Iowa, and he graduated from high school in the spring of 1917, and he and his identical twin brother enlisted in the Marine Corps and went to France. And I've always regretted, he lived to be 96, I've always regretted never asking him about his experiences in the war. I figured it was something he probably didn't want to talk about.
Well, I think you're correct. I mean, I can understand how you feel that way. You know, what a regret not to have had it. And it would have been a very difficult conversation, I'm sure, even much of a century later for him, because it was a devastating war externally and internally. And the few people over the years I had talked to who were World War I vets had a very difficult time discussing it. Really difficult.
They're all gone now.
Well, that is correct. That is correct.
Scott,
And the United States fared a little better. You know, we were actually fighting the war for only 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
We were in it longer than that, but when we had actual fighting troops. But just within that time, the losses were so tragic, so tragic. But the rest of the world lost in the tens of millions.
Well, this is really a phenomenal collection, and I would encourage anyone interested in this history to check it out. It's beautifully, beautifully done. It's put out by the Library of America, edited by A. Scott Berg. It's called World War I in America, told by the Americans who lived it. And I know you've got another interview coming up, Scott, but we really appreciate your time today.
Oh, I appreciate talking with you, Vic. It's always a pleasure. And, you know, this is a story that needs to be told and retold, I think, and especially now. And I just keep going back to this point. You can't really understand where we are today unless you understand the beginnings of all the threads in our lives. And all that begins with World War One.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Vic.
And it was a real pleasure to have Scott Berg back on the program talking about World War One. Don't go away. The Book Nook continues. We're going to be revisiting an interview that I did back in 2011 with Jimmy Breslin, who passed away last week, right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Jimmy Breslin died last week. Jimmy was quite a fellow. He was a well-known columnist and writer in New York City and is often credited as one of the inventors of what was known as the New Journalism. We're going to revisit an interview I did with Jimmy back in 2011. It's the best of The Book Nook. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I keep a short list of writers who I have always wanted to interview, and occasionally I get lucky and I can cross one off the list, and I've got one on the phone with me right now. I'd like to welcome to the program Jimmy Breslin. Hello, Jimmy.
How do you do?
Very well now, sir.
Good.
I've been reading your work for a long time, and I was delighted to see that you put out a new book, and I had an excuse to interview you.
Good.
You've written about Branch Rickey.
Yes.
How did this project come about?
They called me from the that series they have of short books put out by the publisher. And they've got 50 people wrote these books, and they asked me to do one. Now, whether I said Rickey or they said it, I believe I said Branch Rickey. That's a back topic that they wanted that I knew something about. And I said I would do it. I'm sorry.
No worries, sir.
I got rid of it. I've got to change these phones here. All right.
Do you need to do something with that?
I don't know what to do.
The phone's ringing?
No, it won't go. It won't ring anymore. I'll take it off the hook.
Okay, good.
Wait a minute. Okay.
All right.
Yes.
We have some listeners out there who probably have never heard of Branch Rickey.
Yeah. Now, he was in Brooklyn as the head of the Brooklyn Dodgers baseball team in the National League at the time. He's out of Ohio Wesleyan, Methodist studies, religious man in baseball. He played some baseball. And he decided during World War II, the end of World War II, to bring a black into baseball. The rules were against blacks at all time. He was going to do it as a religious exercise. Way down in the meaning, in his wanting to do it, was the chance he could sell a lot of tickets for having this black guy. But that was last. First was to put him in there. So he had a pound of paper, he called it, reading on a ball player named Jackie Robinson, who was out of UCLA and then into the minor leagues with Kansas City Monarchs of the Negro League. Now, he decided that was the player they were going to try to bring in. He asked Clyde Sukforth, who was from Maine, the state of Maine, he was as white as your bones, to go out to Chicago, where the Kansas City Monarchs was playing in the Black League, to talk to Robinson, who was on that team. Well, he went out there. He didn't know one black from the other, and he didn't know a black from a white guy. He was an amazing person when it came to other people. So he got to the ballpark, Comiskey Park, bought a program. He looked up Robinson with the number, and he went to the railing of the box seat he bought a ticket to. He leaned over and he asked the first black player to come by, which one is Jackie Robinson? He had no idea which one was Robinson. So the guy pointed him out, and he called Jackie. Could he talk to him? Robinson came over, and Sukeforth, the main white, talked to him, and Robinson was moved. This guy was, whoever he was seemed real. He couldn't believe a white guy was real. Mm. But it was. He wanted him to come to Brooklyn with him. And he did. The next morning, they're in Montague Street in Brooklyn, and they go up to Branch Rickey's office. They sit down, Sukeforth in the corner, Robinson at the desk across from Rickey, who said to him, "Do you know why you're here?" And Robinson said, "Yes, to play for some black team. You must be starting here in Brooklyn." Rickey said, "No, that isn't why you're here at all. We brought you here to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers." That put Robinson in a shock that took a long time that afternoon to wear off what was going on. Meanwhile, Rickey pulled his jacket off and began to abuse Robinson for his color. He began to throw punches at him to say, "The next thing you're going to get." And he imitated the worst of whites. And Robinson got into it finally, and he understood the promise Rickey was making him to the skies that he would never react when the whites started yelling at him. He said he would. Whereupon Rickey just threw him a contract and said, "Sign this." Everything became real. Mm. And he said then they had to wait until World War II ended so they could talk. And they didn't want to upset anybody or talk about race when they've got this war on. At this time, Rickey lived in Forest Hills section of Queens County. And the pastor of a church down the block, a big, classy Protestant church, was lifted by the army, taken away. Rickey picked up a missile, walked to the church, climbed the steps to the pulpit, and took over the job of being the minister during the last weeks of World War II. He had an audience, a congregation of white women. Their husbands were away in the war. Mm. Rickey lectured them on religion. And then he reached a point where he just decided to tell them that he was going to do a thing that would further religious beliefs in this county and this parish that they were in. And it was to put a black into baseball. He made them swear that they would not talk about it until the war was over. So these women listened to him lecture about putting a black in a baseball for several Sundays, at the conclusion of which they went out into the world knowing something big was going to happen in baseball, which they couldn't tell anybody about. Mm-hmm. And that was how it came about. The war ended, and Rickey put Jackie Robinson into the lineup.
Jimmy Breslin joins us. He's written a book about Branch Rickey. It's part of the Penguin Live series. He joins us by telephone from somewhere, I would guess, in the New York area.
Manhattan. West side of Manhattan.
Jimmy, you actually met Branch Rickey.
Yeah, well, wait a minute now. Let's get the years right. In 1945, the war ending, what am I? I'm 15?
I think you were 8, weren't you?
I don't know. I was 15.
When you met Rickey?
No, a little younger than 15. That's a cinch. At any rate, I went to a football game in the rain at Ebbets Field, the Dodgers ballpark, and it was at a heavy rain, and the team was the Brooklyn Dodgers, football Dodgers, playing the Chicago Rockets. I remember that team. They were in the National Football League. It's changed, rearranged since. But that was that night. in the pouring rain, nobody showed. Finally, I'm sitting there with a kid from the neighborhood, Rusty Wild. We went to see the game in the rain. We took advantage. I'll bet you somebody gave us tickets. So we're there, and then suddenly behind us in the upper deck where we were sitting came Branch Rickey, who spread a blanket over himself to, so you don't freeze to death in the rain, a cold, rainy night. And he sat there. So we told him something. The best thing about football here in Brooklyn was that Sidney Luckman came from here, you know. And he just looked at us. Yeah, right from down here, right from down Flatbush Avenue. He went to Erasmus Hall High School. Then he went up to Columbia. Now he's out with the Chicago Bears, which put him into anger, an anger shock. He couldn't even talk to us because he was being told that he blew the best football player anybody had ever seen. Sidney Luckman was the, a major figure in football, quarterback at Chicago, passing. So he got so mad he wouldn't talk to us. And that was our introduction to Branch Rickey.
On the rare occasions when I think about how I might like to be remembered, I think, you know, I'd like to be remembered for being able to actually have a conversation with somebody like Jimmy Breslin. How would you like to be remembered?
I don't know. I'm selective memories.
Well, you've had this long career.
Keep me innocent in your memories.
Keep you innocent?
Yeah, there's a lot of guilty pleas here I'd like to shed.
Okay, well, you've certainly had a long and interesting career. I'm just going to throw out a couple of really short little subjects, and I wondered if you might
just give me a
comment. What about this one? Son of Sam.
He wrote me. It came from out of, there were murders. Nobody knew where the shootings were coming from, murders of young women. And then came this letter, and it was from Son of Sam, and it was this crazy printing letter, and he was the guy that was doing the shooting. And that began an association, whether I liked it or not. And wound up, I had one day, one night that summer, that the letter came, the letters came to me at the newspaper, the New York Daily News, and I was out with my wife for one night that summer. We were at West Hampton Beach. We went into a bar on Main Street to have one drink, and the traffic outside of a busy street was going by slowly because it was starting to rain, and it kept going. Later that night, they grabbed a car because of the license plates on that street, and it had this Berkowitz in it, who was Son of Sam. And they asked him, they went over what he was doing, and he was there to shoot me. He said the dog with him, he called himself Son of Sam. He had no dog. He made the dog up in his mind. I told him to keep going, not stop. That's the only reason he didn't get out of the car and shoot me. I'm at the bar, sitting in the saloon window. And that's, I had to come to the police headquarters. They wanted me to identify him. And I looked and I saw the face. That's the guy.
Oh, my.
Now, could we take him and throw him out the window, I said.
Oh, my.
That's the Son of Sam summer.
The Son of Sam. And he picked you.
Yep. He was going to shoot me. All the women he was shooting, young women. And I'd be the young man.
He's still around, isn't he?
He's still in the can, and let him rot there. I don't ever want to hear about him.
Yeah. Speaking of crime, what do you think about organized crime these days?
Is it here?
Is there still some around in New York?
I don't know. Yeah, they're in court talking.
Oh, yeah, they are.
You can't keep them quiet. What was ever left? It's a dying art being a boss of mafia. There's nobody. The Howard Beach, where John Gotti reigned on the sidewalks across Bay Boulevard, there's nobody, one gangster left.
How about this subject? Something you know a lot about. Tabloid journalism.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Are they going to be here in 2 years? I'm making a bet no.
The newspapers or just tabloid journalism?
Well, I mean, the tabloids, I can't see them making it.
Uh-huh.
The big newspapers, what are they? The New York Times, and they keep going on to wire more and more. Who knows what they're going to do?
They seem to be losing writers, too.
Yep, you lose everybody. It's changing.
Did you have a favorite newspaper that you wrote for?
The New York Daily News.
For sure.
I mean, I was there the longest. It was the best for me. And it's gone.
Yeah.
I mean, it will be, I think.
Okay, one more topic.
Well, the Chicago Tribune ain't healthy.
No, they're not. One more topic. New York City.
Yes, better than ever.
It's better than ever?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
It's the only place in the world to live. Why are you wasting your time elsewhere?
Well, I sure loved
it. The streets are so crowded with people. Who knows where they're from? Manhattan now, you barely can walk the streets. They're so crowded with people. And that's a healthy sign. I love it.
Uh-huh. So you're going to be in Chicago next week for Blago's trial. Are you covering it?
Yep. I got to do a book so far. Yep.
How's that coming along? He's a fascinating character.
Yes. Yes, I just spoke to him before. Yes.
You just spoke to him?
Yeah, I speak to him during the day.
So he's collaborating with the book?
Well, we're talking. We're talking. He's fine.
What's he like?
Well, he's no dope.
No, he couldn't be to get elected governor.
What's that?
Getting elected governor of Illinois, you'd have to be pretty smart, I think.
Well, the other thing is there was supposed to be $1 billion stolen. He happened to be sitting on huge money. So I go out there to see him to start if I'm going to do this. And I'm not there a couple of times, and I don't smell money.
Mm.
And not close even. After a while, I began to say, what the hell are they worried about this guy? He ain't got any money. And the answer is he doesn't. You could see that when he had to start worrying about paying lawyers. Huge amount of money needed for this case, and he doesn't have it.
Hmm. So, what does money smell like?
It looks. It's got a look, a smell. It's got a, you know when it's there.
Okay.
You could tell. But, well, if you come around me, you could give the answer to that.
Okay.
He's got nothing.
Okay. Isn't it true that you used to go to work in an ambulance?
Once.
Just once?
Once.
Yeah.
Oh, I hitched rides in ambulances, but once I went for real.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was knocked down.
You were knocked down?
Well, I mean, life.
Oh.
And I had to be into a newspaper office. Had to be.
Oh.
And I couldn't find any cab or anything. I got in an ambulance and went to work.
I love it.
I was in very bad shape from the night before.
Yeah.
Desperate shape.
Well, you've kind of cleaned up your act, though, haven't you?
No, my liver did that.
Okay. Well, isn't a journalist supposed to drink a lot? Isn't that
good? I don't think it ever helped.
No?
It helped me, I say it didn't. Doesn't do anything for you to give you a hangover under which you could barely move the next morning.
Yeah. Well,
but it's fun at night.
Well, I knew that Studs liked his cocktails.
Oh, boy. We had fun.
In fact, he made me a cocktail once. It was one of the high points of my life, I think.
Oh, he was terrific.
It was a Stoli. I think he was out of gin.
He's terrific.
Well, Jimmy,
a great loss.
It's always been a dream of mine to talk to you, and we really appreciate you taking the time to be on the program.
Thank you for calling. You embarrassed me by being nice.
Jimmy Breslin, recorded back in 2011. And he died last week. As you heard him at the end of that interview, he said he was embarrassed that I was being nice to him. When I called him up that day, I was being very polite and complimentary when I got him on the line. And He said, "I'm going to hang up the phone if you don't stop being nice to me." And that's just the way he was. When he died, the New York Times had his obituary beginning on the front page and went inside for a full page. He was that well known in New York. Here are some brief excerpts from the obituary. Quote, "Love or loathe him, none could deny Mr. Breslin's enduring impact on the craft of narrative nonfiction. He often explained that he merely applied a sports writer's visual sensibility to the news columns. Avoid the scrum of journalists gathered around the winner, he would advise, and go directly to the loser's locker. This is how you find your gravedigger." Early on, Mr. Breslin developed the persona of the hard-drinking, dark-humored everyman from Queens, so consumed by life's injustices and his six children that he barely had time to comb his wild black mane. While this persona shared a beer with the truth, Mr. Breslin also admired Dostoevsky, swam every day, hadn't had a drink in more than 30 years, wrote a shelf full of books, and adhered to a demanding work ethic that required his presence in the moment, from a civil rights march in Alabama to a perp walk in Brooklyn, no matter what. He never learned to drive. Jimmy Breslin, what a guy. He cut long-standing ties over small slights, often published an annual list of the people I'm not talking to this year, and rarely hesitated to target powerful friends, depending upon his depth of outrage and the time until deadline. He would occasionally refer to those who had fallen out of his favor only by their initials. I always wanted to interview Jimmy Breslin, and I did that day in April 2011. We'll miss you, Jimmy. You were one of the great ones. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic Mecunis.